From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, why the Army Corps of Engineers needs 8 years for its fix to keeping Asian carp out of the Great Lakes. Plus, employers say they can't find enough workers in Michigan with the right skills to fill job openings. Here's a way to fix that.
We've lumped kids into two buckets, either or. Either you're smart enough to go to college or you're not, and that's just a terrible way to sort kids.
Why killing coyotes to protect livestock is a losing proposition.
Coyotes are sort of true survivors of the predator world. You know, it's very hard to control them lethally. It really just doesn't work.
The magic of underwater photography of Great Lakes shipwrecks.
To go down and see the two halves of this shipwreck ripped apart and to see what Mother Nature can do, it's just really haunting.
Those stories and more on Stateside today. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Doing underwater photography in extreme conditions, it's not the run-of-the-mill career path.
I started getting into cave diving when I was about 14 to 15 and kind of fell in love with technical diving. That was my first step into this world.
We'll meet underwater photographer Becky Kagan Schott later in the hour. But first, people worried about Asian carp infecting the Great Lakes have been anxiously awaiting a long overdue carp battle plan from the Army Corps of Engineers, a report held up for 6 months by the Trump administration. Well, now the Army Corps is free to talk details. And as it does, the reaction among some in Michigan is disappointment and disbelief because the Army Corps says it will take 8 years until 2025 to get its fix in place. Details were unveiled at a recent meeting in Muskegon. John Allen directs Michigan's Office of the Great Lakes. He was at that meeting. Welcome, John. The Army Corps is saying it wants to make modifications at a lock and a dam on a river in Illinois to keep the carp out of the Chicago waterways, the so-called Brandon Road Plan. What's in this fix?
So the Brandon Road is an existing Army Corps of Engineers dam and a lock system. The lock system allows for the movements of barge traffic up and down the river. And the plan calls for modifications, an expansion and modification to that lock to add additional technologies like additional electric barrier, flushing locks, more water pressure and flow that would drive invasive species out, and some other technologies that would make the lock more secure from the movements of Asian carp up through the river.
Okay, so just making it unappealing for Asian carp to want to try to push through.
And yeah, one of the other technologies that they're proposing is something called complex noise. Asian carp, especially the silver carp, if you notice the videos on YouTube of them jumping,
yeah.
Part of that is their reaction to noise. They're sort of noise averse, and creation of complex noise through that lock system is believed to be able to drive them out or keep it a less hospitable place.
And I see the price tag is something in the range of $275 million. But now to the timing, 8 years, 2025. What were your first thoughts when you heard that?
Well, we've been advocating urgency all along. We think that this is a problem of epic proportions. We think that of the 180-some invasive species in the Great Lakes now, none of them have ever been removed, and we want to keep one out so we don't have to figure out how to remove it or manage it once it gets into the system. So 8 years is just another long haul in a system that we see some risk. If you remember, just this last summer, a carp was found within, 9 miles or so of Lake Michigan past the electric barriers that exist there.
Yes.
We see that still manifests significant risk in the system. And we're hoping as much action can take place as humanly possible, as soon as possible, to keep lowering the risk.
I have to imagine those of you at the meeting asked the Army Corps of Engineers, why 8 years?
Well, their answer is in their process. Right now, the proposal is something they call the tentatively selected plan. They call it the TSP. A little bit uncommon to the Corps process, where they used to do a lot of studies and then come out with a near final plan at the end. They have come out with a plan sort of mid-review, if you will, for more public comment. So the final plan isn't even due out until next June, at which point then it goes to the chief. It's called the chief's report, and that report is not due out until 2019. And the chief's report is ultimately the final decision within the Corps, go, no go, that ultimately gets moved to Congress. Without a positive chief's report, it doesn't get moved to Congress. And then Congress has to act and decide whether it's fundable and on what time frame. And then, obviously, with final engineering and construction, that takes the Corps out to 2025.
When you think that we've been eyeing these carp nervously for the better part of a decade, does Washington just not get it?
Well, the folks in the Michigan delegation certainly do, the folks that we've worked with. And I think around the basin.
Yeah, in fact, it's worth noting, Michigan's congressional delegation, both parties have been banging on about this at every chance they get.
Absolutely. And the state legislatures and many others. So we're not without advocates and friends and colleagues and supporters. We were frustrated by the delay. We advocated and pushed hard for the release of the report. It is out. Remember, it is a tentatively selected plan, not a final plan. And we will continue to make sure that the Corps hears of our concerns and our urgencies and everything we can to help move that process along. We will be there.
In this plan that they present, is that a final solution in your view?
The plan as presented is something we're thinking of as an interim solution. Now, 8 years may feel a long time for people for an interim solution. I testified in Muskegon that a final solution ultimately looks at more separation. This plan really gets at one species. And ultimately, the goal is to put enough separation in that system to really stop the two-way movement of species, those things moving out of the Great Lakes into the Mississippi, and carp and other things that may be moving up the Mississippi into the Great Lakes. Those two bodies need to be separated by some mechanism, isolated from each other, and by some mechanism to really stop the two-way movement. So our long-term desire is to have more long-term solutions in that system that provide for that separation.
There's probably a lot of shipping interests that are going to be complicating this.
Well, there are. That system has developed since the mid-1800s and expanded in the late 1800s, the Chicago Ship and Sanitary Canal and the river systems. There are a series of barges that connect the Great Lakes all the way to the Mississippi, all the way down to Houston, New Orleans. And there are some real interests in that to make sure that those economies stay whole. One of the things we keep looking at or talking about is the need to look at the whole core lock and dam system, not just one lock and dam, in terms of what the efficiency is and also the environmental protection. We think that those can happen together. If we only look at one lock and dam and slowing cargo down, the industry says that's $26 million of harm. But if we look more holistically at that system and optimize it as a freight flow, we think we can get the environmental protections necessary and possibly even enhance the movement of goods through there. So I don't think those are necessarily contrary to each other.
But it certainly does seem like a lot of heavy lifting lies ahead.
Literally and figuratively, yes.
John Allen directs Michigan's Office of the Great Lakes. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's a big game hunt with big investment and a lot of jobs on the line. But at what price to taxpayers? Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is back with us. And Daniel, this week Wisconsin's governor signed the legislation that landed that monster project from Foxconn, promising a $10 billion investment and up to 13,000 jobs. But remind us what Wisconsin taxpayers are on the hook for.
Overall, it's about a $3 billion package. Of that, $2.85 billion in cash over 15 years.
Whew.
That will be paid to help off to Foxconn to help offset some of their essentially, in layman's terms, startup costs associated with it.
And how is Foxconn's track record of keeping promises like, hey, we're, you know, $10 billion investment up to 13,000 jobs?
Ask the people in central Pennsylvania. They got promises that Foxconn was going to bring a plant there and they never really materialized. As it happens, there's a story in the New York Times this week out of Brazil, and the same kind of thing happened in Brazil. And Foxconn blamed the Brazil situation on the implosion of the Brazilian economy, deal making with a previous presidential administration, all of which may be true, but nevertheless, it kind of speaks to Foxconn's somewhat spotty record here.
And we know Michigan's angling for another Foxconn prize because it wants to get into the automotive sector. Is Lansing teed up to serve up the kind of juicy incentives that Wisconsin gave?
I doubt it. When you look at the kind of fight that they went through to get through the MyThrive so-called legislation.
And remind us what that was.
Well, it's essentially a legislation that would make that would incentivize companies to create jobs, and they would be able to capture taxes, income taxes associated with new hires. So if a new job is created, there'd be a portion of, and they have to be a certain amount of jobs. I think it's over, depending on the size of the investment, it's either 250 or 500, and it's scaled to investments and everything. But the bottom line is it would enable companies to capture a portion of their employees' state income tax as an offset. The theory being that if those companies didn't come and invest, those jobs would not be created. So they are incremental gains to the marketplace.
So that got through.
But one of the things that clearly the legislature has a real problem with is the hangover from the tax credits that were given out by the Granholm administration at the end of the global financial meltdown, where you had a number of auto companies that were on their knees, and clearly in the case of General Motors and Chrysler, but also others. And at the time, I remember a senior automotive executive, I think it was at Ford, said to me, if you're an automaker, there's no way you can't take advantage of these Michigan tax credits. They are the most attractive tax credits in the country. And as a result, we produce now more cars, the highest percentage of cars of any state in the United States. It's almost 20% of the vehicles produced in the U.S. are produced in Michigan. That's the good news and the bad news. I really think that this legislature, if faced with a Foxconn-like package and saying, listen, you got to come up with these billions of dollars, they're going to say, we're not going to do it.
Well, what about, now we know Amazon is, has the sweepstakes, mm-hmm. the national sweepstakes for a second. Mm-hmm. Headquarters, Detroit wants its shot, mm-hmm. West Michigan wants a shot, and now we hear Windsor does too. But how does that contrast with what Dan Gilbert is doing downtown, including yesterday's announcement of about $2.1 billion investment to renovate four more buildings? How do those weigh out?
Dan Gilbert, up until now, has really privately financed almost everything he's done. And that's something that people need to think about for a moment here. It's been private capital. A lot of these buildings that he's bought over, going back to 2010, have been bought with cash. And what he's, for the first time, he's put out this proposal that he proposes to avail himself of the new MyThrive incentives, up to $250 million, on a $2.1 billion package of a four-building renovation and construction. It's a lot smaller percentage, I think, in a lot of ways. But, he is largely privately financed, and I think that's a real difference. But any way you cut it, if you look at these things in terms of percentages, governments at some level are kicking in, and I think a lot of developers and investors are basically saying, look, you're going to benefit from this as much as I'm going to benefit from it in different ways, that they increase commerce, other kinds of taxes, restaurants, bars, other shops that open to service those people. That is a net gain to the community, and therefore you got to have some skin in the game. Mm-hmm. It's not unlike what happened with the Grand Bargain back during the bankruptcy. Foundations came forward with private money and said, look, we want to help here, but we are not going to do it all by ourselves. The taxpayers have to put some skin in the game, and in fact, the legislature in that case did, because they were able to eliminate a much larger liability for a much lower price.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes, as always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Standing on the shores of the Great Lakes on a sunny late summer day, it's virtually impossible to think of those sparkling waves as a death trap. But divers have seen what those angry lakes can do to ships, and that includes noted underwater photographer Becky Kagan Schott. She has taken her camera on dives in extreme environments all over the world, including under ice in the Arctic. But Becky's favorite place to dive, the Great Lakes. And Becky Kagan Schott is with us now via Skype. Pleasure to welcome you to Stateside, Becky.
Thank you. Happy to be talking with you.
How long have you been diving the Great Lakes?
23 years ago when I did my advanced course in Lake Erie. And I only did a couple dives and after that moved to Florida and kind of forgot about the Great Lakes until about 7 years ago when I was sort of reintroduced to them, sort of reignited that passion.
What got you back here? What reintroduced you to the Great Lakes?
I was working with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and NOAA and Sony on a project in Lake Huron called Project Ship Hunt. And we were diving some really incredible wrecks and they were out hunting for brand new virgin shipwrecks. And they actually found two brand new wrecks and we were the first to go down and dive them. It sort of just reignited this passion for exploration. And not everything has been found in the Great Lakes. And that's really exciting to me. I also found that Lake Huron and the other Great Lakes have cleared up quite a bit in 23 years. And they're not kind of the green, murky, yucky visibility that I'd remembered from a long time ago. They're actually quite clear and quite nice to dive.
So the idea that there are still uncovered wrecks that are there waiting for you to explore them, it's got to be really attractive.
It is. And I'm not typically the one out that's searching and finding the wrecks, but it really means a lot to me when I'm brought in on a project to help photograph and video and document a wreck, maybe after it's been found, because to see something that's been sitting lost, basically lost to time for maybe over a century or longer, and then to be the first human eyes laid on that and to be able to share that with the world, it's pretty incredible.
I watched your video, stunning images of one of the most famous wrecks on the Great Lakes, and that is the SS Daniel J. Morrell. We'll remind everyone, it sank in Lake Huron in November of 1966, and only one man survived out of that crew of 29. Tell us what it was like photographing the Daniel J. Morrell, because we're talking about two halves. How far apart are they?
They're about 5 miles apart, so you can do it in one day if you've got good conditions, but typically, like we've been spending about a week out there at a time just to document or shoot imagery of both sides of the wreck.
What's the environment like? Is it cold? Are there currents that you have to worry about?
It is. So the Daniel J. Morrell, it's pretty far offshore. The bow section actually is maybe around 24 miles or so offshore. And so it's quite a hike just to get out there. So you have to have really good conditions because obviously these wrecks sink for a reason, you know, bad storms. So we don't want to become another one. So we go out there and then usually dive with a pretty highly trained team of divers because they're quite deep. They lie in about 215 feet of water. So we use rebreathers and mixed gases, dry suits with heated undergarments sometimes because it's about 37, 38 degrees on the bottom. It can be quite cold. Typically, I've been going out in June, which is a colder month, but we've been getting great visibility in the month of June. And so for my images, I really try to focus on these big, wide, grand shots to really show the overall perspective of what the shipwreck looks like sitting there in the bottom of Lake Huron. If I hit it in June, then usually we've been getting much nicer visibility.
As you saw the Morrell and you entered her, what were some of your thoughts and your feelings?
Well, the Daniel J. Morrell has quickly become one of my favorite shipwrecks anywhere in the Great Lakes, and that's pretty much due to Dennis Hale's story. His story of survival, it really touched me, and it's really powerful to me. And to go down and see the two halves of this shipwreck ripped apart and to see what Mother Nature can do, it's just really haunting. To go down and go inside and see, you know, a place like the engine room and see things still in place, like there's a tool bench with tools still sitting on the tool bench. There's a telegraph there. You'll see gauge panels. There's even some shoes lying around in there. It's just a sort of a reminder that this is where somebody worked and, you know, this is where somebody probably lost their life. So with my images, I'm really trying to capture that and, you know, remind people that this shipwreck is here and the story is real and, you know, make sure people don't forget.
Doing underwater photography in extreme conditions is not one run-of-the-mill career path. How did you come to be doing this work?
Well, I've always been passionate about scuba diving ever since I was 12, living in Pennsylvania. And I didn't know that I was going to become a photographer until a little later on. But I picked up a camera right away when I was maybe 13 because I wanted to show my family and friends what I was seeing underwater and why I loved it so much. So shortly after, when I was about 13, I lived in Florida. And we moved to Florida. And that was a really great opportunity to explore other types of scuba diving. And I found that I couldn't always afford to go out on boats all the time because they're quite expensive. I couldn't get there because I couldn't even drive to them. So in my backyard in Florida were the crystal clear springs. And in the springs, you've got caverns and cave systems. So I started getting into cave diving when I was about 14 to 15 and kind of fell in love with technical diving. That was my first step into this world. And I just kept combining my passion for photography and taking pictures with technical diving. And I never dreamed I'd end up specializing in extreme environments, but I found that these places are very rarely photographed. And to be a part of exploration teams is really exciting. To go and show somebody something that is very rare on our planet is sort of what drives me.
When you're diving and doing your work in the Great Lakes, these freshwater behemoths, how is that different than doing your work in oceans?
The Great Lakes are very different than oceans. Even though they're considered the inland seas, they can turn pretty rough pretty quickly. So we have a lot of respect for them, a lot of respect for the cold water. You know, we have to dress properly and, you know, we do a lot with our equipment. But I mean, there's no marine life to really worry about. You know, we have experienced some strong currents, but typically there's less current in the Great Lakes. The freshwater is a little easier on your gear and whatnot. But I mean, we treat them very similar to the ocean because I mean, they have their own set of quirks.
I'm sure you have to just kind of treat each one a little bit differently.
Yeah, they do. And so I just got back from diving in Lake Superior for 3 weeks. And, you know, I've been diving all over four of the five of the Great Lakes this summer. And Lake Superior is an entirely different beast. Just before we got there at the end of August, some wind came through and the water temperatures plummeted to about 45 degrees on the surface. We were doing 270-foot dives. We really had to reevaluate our plan kind of on the fly because we didn't know the water was going to be that cold because we can't decompress and stay in the water for 2 hours or longer in that cold water. So they can really change very quickly and you kind of have to be aware of that.
Now you've done, you say, four of the five Great Lakes. What's left to do?
I have Lake Ontario left to do, which funny enough is the lake that is closest to me and where I live in Pennsylvania. But that's going to be first on my list next year.
And ultimately, I understand you're hoping to have a book of wrecks of all five Great Lakes?
Yeah, I'm working on several different projects. I'd love to do a museum, like gallery exhibit at some point, showcasing some of the best wrecks in all five Great Lakes, and working on a coffee table book of all five of the Great Lakes. Again, showcasing some of the best wrecks in the lakes, trying to capture them in a different artistic way.
Becky Kagan Schott, underwater photographer. We are looking forward to that coffee table book because your work is exquisite. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much.
A reminder that we always look forward to hearing from you. We want to know what stories are you focusing on or issues that you want to hear more about. It's easy to let us know. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio, certainly at michiganradio.org. Click the link that says Stateside, and you can always email us, stateside@michiganradio.org.
Creation.
Part of the community. The next idea.
It doesn't always look like the dots connect, but they do.
So many innovative ideas start with an inventor just observing a simple event like Newton's falling apple. Today's guest on The Next Idea has had several of those moments, and they've led him to create something that he calls the Synergen. It creates electricity from the temperature differences between warm and cold water. Emil Uril of West Michigan left his day job as an electrical engineer to finish his invention, take it to the marketplace, and by founding a company called Synergy Power LLC. How did you get the idea for this Synergen?
Well, it kind of starts when my wife introduced me to ice skating. I didn't learn how to ice skate till I was in my early 30s, and she bought me skating lessons one Christmas, and I kind of gave her a strange look, like, what are you doing? Because I had next to zero coordination. Long story short, I went to the ice arena, learned how to skate. I fell in love with playing ice hockey. Then that wanted me to build an ice rink at home. And being an engineer and someone that loves to try out new things, I wanted to refrigerate part of that ice rink. So that led me down a path where I started to self-teach thermodynamics. I basically wound up creating my own chiller system from a used central air unit. Going through that process, I learned something related to thermodynamics that's referred to as saturated vapor pressure. So one day I was looking at the propane tank on the gas grill and realized that the pressure in that tank on a really cold winter day is on the order of 80 PSI, and then on a really hot summer day, the pressure could go as high as 220 or 250 PSI. And then I started envisioning a pressure gauge on the tank with a needle. And I realized, even though it's just a ridiculously small amount of work being produced, the fact that that needle moves from 80 PSI position to the 220 PSI position, it's doing work. It's actually producing power, that little tiny needle. That led me down a path of building several prototypes where the purpose was to figure out how to make a bigger needle that could actually do some real work and produce some real power.
So a Synergen, what is it? What does it look like?
Well, the Synergen basically is about the size of a round kitchen table. This is the current model. One thing to note about this device is it is highly scalable. For a number of years, I had a prototype that was on the order of 2 feet by 2 feet square, and I had many smaller prototypes like that. So this past January, my wife and I made the decision where it was just time to build the next size up, because I had a lot of potential investors look at the smaller units, and they'd be like, wow, this is great, this is amazing. And they would always ask me, is it scalable? And I would tell them, you know, basically in theory, yes, it is scalable. And they would sort of believe me, but the proof is in the pudding, as they say. And so it just came down to making the decision to build this larger unit. So now I literally have approximately a 500-pound pre-production unit that if you supply it with warm water on one side and cool water on the other, it uses that temperature difference and produces direct torque. Now, some people may want to use that rotary torque to turn a generator and produce power, while others may want to use just the direct mechanical power, for example, to turn a large water pump. So there's a variety of uses with it.
So here you have this device, the Synergen, that makes electricity by harnessing that difference, that delta in temperature between hot and cold water. Who do you see being able to make the best use of this?
The alternative energy market. There's a whole group of individuals out there. They dabble into alternative energy, or they're practically experts in the area where they're purchasing solar or wind generating devices. But there's also a market out there where if someone has a cabin or a home that's in the woods where wind and solar just doesn't work, a lot of times these people are remote enough where the expense to pay for the utility to come out and run power lines to their home is very expensive. They may have a wood stove or a wood boiler system that they're currently using for heating their home or their cabin. With the Synergen, they'll be able to take the Synergen and put that directly in line with their hot water heating loop, just like adding another appliance onto their wood boiler system. They would be able to provide power for their cabin or their home. When you use electricity in an efficient manner, you can run a coffee maker, high-efficiency refrigerator. You can even do a load of laundry once a week. You can run lights, LED, TV, laptop. There's a lot of appliances that can be run with that amount of power.
What would you do in summer if people aren't running wood boilers? I get that in January. What would you do in July?
Solar hot water heaters. With the Synergen, you have evacuated tube solar collectors. You also have what's called solar concentrators, which are more of a parabolic trough that reflects the radiation onto a pipe. And there's even an application where you simply lay black poly tubing on the roof of a house or a garage, and you harness the heat from the sun that way.
How has this process been in terms of finding financial backers?
It all started out with that decision back in January that my wife and I made to personally finance this next size unit, which has now been built, which has proven that it is highly scalable. If you wanted to turn it into a 50,000-pound machine and make it 20 times or 50 times the size, there's no reason why you couldn't. You'd have to certainly make sure the mechanics of everything is strong enough, but from a thermodynamics perspective, I don't know what the upper limit of scalability is. So it's really from the residential market to even harvesting low-grade thermal energy that's currently going out into the environment for large thermal power plants. There is literally billions of BTUs of heat that is going out into the environment that could be harvested with this technology on a much larger scale to produce emission-free power for tens of thousands of homes, and it wouldn't take up acres of space of solar farms and wind farms. Those things are good, but there's a huge revenue of energy that's out there that hasn't been tapped into. So as far as the financial backing with this, basically, the late end of spring, I acquired my first private investor, which was really an amazing story in itself. It all started out with chocolate birthday cake requested from our middle son, Paul. He was turning 11 years old, and he asked for chocolate birthday cake. And needless to say, he didn't feel so great that night. And we have sort of white carpet in his bedroom, and that required us to call a carpet cleaning service the next day. The carpet cleaning guy saw me going in and out of the garage, and he didn't really talk to me, and then he basically asked my wife, you know, what's your husband up to? And my wife simply mentioned to him, he's working on a new type of alternative energy system. Basically, the conversation went something like this, where he said, my dad loves out-of-the-box thinkers. He started up a business of his own. And literally in about a month from that conversation, his father sat across the table from me in his office and said he wanted to invest. I mean, I remember lots and lots of people telling me that you never know where that connection is going to come from. And here it all financially started over my son asking for chocolate birthday cake. You can't make that stuff up.
Indeed. Emil Uriel of West Michigan, who is now the founder of a company called Synergy Power LLC and inventor of a device called the Synergen, which creates electricity from the temperature differences between warm and cold water. Thank you so much for spending time with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you very much.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Does killing coyotes make things safer for livestock? Last winter, we brought you the story of a sporting goods store near the Irish Hills that was holding a bounty hunt on coyotes, a response, they said, to customers coming in talking about their worry about their chicken coops or the family dog. Dr. Megan Draheim says, guess what? There is no evidence killing coyotes makes livestock safer and, in fact, can make the coyote-human problem even worse. She's a lecturer in conservation biology and human dimensions of wildlife at Virginia Tech, where she specializes in studying conflict between humans and wildlife. She's with us now via Skype. Pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So there is actually a federal program, isn't there, that funds coyote kills, with some 77,000 of them killed last year. What are some of the methods these federal wildlife services workers use in going after coyotes?
First of all, I should clarify that Wildlife Services doesn't only use lethal control methods. They also use non-lethal control, but lethal control certainly happens quite often under their watch. They use everything from traps, sort of your standard leg hold traps, to these collars that they'll actually put on sheep and other livestock so that when a predator bites into it, it releases a poison. They'll use M44 bombs, which are basically cyanide bombs. So when an animal chews it, that'll shoot cyanide into them. And that actually causes a lot of unintentional deaths too. So domestic dogs are killed and other wildlife too that's not being targeted.
I would gather there could be some collateral damage there. And why do you believe, Megan, that this is the wrong approach to handling conflict between predators and humans? Why do you think we need to reconsider lethal control?
So first of all, I think there's a whole ethical side to it. But setting that aside, there's also just a lot of practical implications of this. Lethal control does not work in many cases, or even in most cases, and there's growing evidence that researchers are accumulating that this is true. In some cases, lethal control for predators such as coyotes, for example, they're pack animals, right? They live in social groups. So when you kill one member of that group, the pack might dissolve. And that opens up the possibility that new animals are going to come into the area. Those animals might not be quite as savvy about the territory and that they might actually increase predation.
Does the science back that up? Do statistics back up the fact that you actually see more predation after lethal control measures?
Yeah, and so that's true not in all cases, but we've certainly seen where that can happen. And certainly we've seen in many cases that predation doesn't actually decrease with lethal control.
And this trend, you say, that has been seen when lethal methods are used, we actually might see more predation. This isn't true just in the U.S., is it? Other parts of the world have seen the same thing?
That's correct. So there was a recent study that came out from South Africa, actually, that showed similar findings. And also there was an interesting case study that came out of Australia looking at cattle and dingoes that showed, again, similar findings.
In your piece for The Conversation, I thought you drew an interesting comparison. You describe lethal control, such as killing coyotes, as akin to doctors overprescribing antibiotics to their patients. Talk a little more about that.
Sure. So I think many of your listeners have probably heard about the antibiotic crisis that we're having in this country. Part of that comes from people being overprescribed antibiotics, also livestock being overprescribed antibiotics and some other issues with that. But basically what happens is when bacteria are exposed to antibiotics, eventually some of those bacteria form a resistance to it. And then those are the bacteria that survive and multiply, and then you end up with bacteria that are resistant to these antibiotics. But many doctors still prescribe antibiotics in cases where it's pretty unlikely that a bacteria is actually the problem, and it's more likely that a virus is the problem. So, for example, somebody goes to their doctor and they have a cold. it might make the patient feel better if they're prescribed antibiotics because it feels like their concerns are being heard. There's something that they can do. They see an action, and there's an action that they can take that they feel like is helping them. But in fact, the antibiotic probably isn't really doing anything. And again, in fact, if you look broadly at the country, that antibiotic being prescribed might actually be doing more harm than good.
So the idea of, let's say, killing coyotes to respond to concerns that farmers or ranchers or homeowners might have about attacks on their animals, are you saying that's kind of like giving someone a prescription for an antibiotic because it makes them feel better?
I think in a lot of cases, yes, that's true. There's something tangible being done. They see the results of it. There's, you know, dead predators at the end of the day. So they feel like those concerns are being addressed. The problem is that that might not be the most effective way of addressing those concerns. I think in general, we're seeing that non-lethal methods can be more effective. They can be more cost-effective, too.
So let's talk about the effective ways, non-lethal effective ways. What tends to work in controlling coyote population?
Part of the complexity in working with non-lethal methods is that there's not necessarily one method that fits best for all situations. For example, to protect livestock, sometimes people put up flagellae, which are basically these hanging strips of material that wave in the wind and might deter predators because they just look odd. But sometimes predators, you know, they're smart. They figure out that actually this doesn't do anything. So using things like flagellae, you often have to sort of move them around from place to place. Guard animals are a good example, too. So people might have dogs that sort of are raised within their sheep herd. The dogs are out there to protect them from coyotes, both to deter them and also to go after the coyote if the coyote does try to come in. Other animals are used for guard animals, too. So you see llamas and animals like that that tend to be sort of territorial and fairly aggressive towards predators. You can use chemical repellents, so things that just aren't attractive to predators in general. So there's a whole variety of methods, and oftentimes you need to use more than one method to protect livestock. There's also, importantly, changes in livestock husbandry that are important. So for example, when you let sheep outside completely unattended by people, you know, if you bring them in during lambing season into fenced-in areas that are closer to humans, that can help to reduce predation. There's sort of other things just from that perspective, from sort of the livestock management perspective, that can help a lot too.
Megan, how important is this question that we're digging into about coyotes in the larger issue of ancient tensions between humans and predators? And of course, the predators are just doing what they do naturally.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's a large part of it here. We have deeply ingrained cultural understandings of the relationship between humans and predators in many places and in many cases. You know, that really plays a role in how we're dealing with human-wildlife conflict these days and human-predator conflicts in particular. And so a lot of times what we're doing isn't necessarily based on the best science. It's based on what people have always done and what feels right, what feels like it's actually accomplishing something.
What's at stake here if we don't shift over to a different approach to dealing with natural predators like coyotes?
Well, we're seeing growing evidence of the importance of predators in the landscape and how they really help to maintain a healthy ecosystem. Coyotes are sort of true survivors of the predator world. You know, it's very hard to control them lethally. It really just doesn't work. You know, their populations will rebound. We've seen their expansion of their home range over time, so now it's across the U.S. But other predators aren't as lucky. You know, we've seen that wolves can certainly be exterminated from an area and other predators as well. So we can see this very detrimental effect with these larger apex predators. And that has this cascading effect on an ecosystem around them. And I also think that there's a larger ethical issue here. There's certainly the animal welfare implications of killing a lot of animals. But there's also, you know, how we relate to the natural world. And we certainly see a problem with sort of separation of human culture and the natural world and all of the cascading problems that have resulted from that. And I think that this does play a role in that.
Dr. Megan Draheim, a lecturer in conservation biology and human dimensions of wildlife at Virginia Tech, where she specializes in studying conflict between humans and wildlife. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us and for being with us on Stateside.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Michigan companies have the help wanted sign out, But it's not always working. Some companies are actually turning down work because they don't have enough workers. The need's especially pressing in the skilled trades. And that's why the state of Michigan has launched the Career Pathways Alliance, creating career connections, guiding students to career pathways. With us now from Lansing is Roger Curtis, the Michigan Department of Talent and Economic Development Director. Great to have you with us, Roger.
Thank you so much for having me.
How big is Michigan's talent gap? I mean, I guess I'm wondering how many posted jobs, for instance, are going unfilled?
Oh, it's huge. As we're talking, it's probably 100,000 jobs going unfilled right now. So we have a huge talent gap. But a lot of that talent gap is a career awareness gap. And so I think that starts with the very early ages of changing the conversation of all the different pathways that students can take, and thus was born the Michigan Career Pathways Alliance.
How can the Michigan Career Pathways Alliance address this talent gap and help these companies get the workers they need?
Well, you know, when the governor brought me to Michigan, and I was very blessed and honored to have this opportunity, we started talking about the talent gap. And the first thing I told him was we really need to address some of the fundamental issues in education right now. And I know the governor's 21st Century on Education addressed many of those, and I was on that commission. That's why I'm saying we didn't get into the career and technical education side as much as we wanted to, just because there were so many other things. So that's what we did. Superintendent Whiston and I formed some work groups, which became the alliance that we're talking about, and really took a deep dive into some of the things in education that we need to do. And I want to start with probably the most fundamental, and that is changing the conversation. I think a lot of adults have these very preconceived negative stereotypes of professional trades in Michigan and don't really have an idea of what they're really like and how much they've changed over the years. And that's parents, that's teachers, that's counselors, that's even coaches. And the influence that we have on these kids is really incredible. And so we need to change the conversation and talk about multiple career pathways and a lot of on and off ramps, too.
What kind of jobs are we talking about? And are they good paying jobs, you know, that can lead to true careers?
You know, a lot of them are. And skeptics are going to say, well, there's always the job at McDonald's that's posted on mytalent.org. And yes, those are there. But there's a lot of great paying jobs, high demand, high wage jobs in IT, healthcare, construction, advanced manufacturing. And these are going to lead to great careers because these are very high-tech jobs, and they may not all require a 4 or 6 year degree. A lot of them just require a bachelor's degree from a community college, apprenticeships. But I can tell you, the jobs that we're talking about, 70% of them are going to require post-secondary education, whatever it may be. And so that's what our focus needs to be on for kids, because far too long, I think, us adults, going back to us again, we've lumped kids into two buckets, either or. Either you're smart enough to go to college or you're not. And that's just a terrible way to sort kids. And so we want to start talking about the multiple pathways, exposing adults to those pathways. I mean, when you walk into a manufacturing facility now, and the cliche is true, many of them you can eat off the floor. You walk into a piece of construction equipment now, a grader, it looks like the deck of the USS Enterprise or something. I mean, everything has become so high tech anymore. And we need to expose those adults that have the influence over the kids, as well as the kids, to these careers and start changing the conversation.
Specifically, how does that happen? What kinds of recommendations have been issued? I know Superintendent Whiston came out with an executive directive with some recommendations. What kinds of steps might we be seeing in the schools to really make this all happen?
Well, he did. We have 17 initiatives that we took to the governor, and he loved them all. We announced them all. And at the announcement a couple months ago, Superintendent Whiston signed an order through the Department of Education, I believe made 9 of them effective immediately. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not some heavy lifting to get them implemented. But then the other 8, we're going to have to work with our legislative folks here in Lansing. And I think there will be a great deal of bipartisan support there. So I'm very optimistic about getting the legislative support. But the other 9, they really deal with career exploration, providing the time in the Michigan Merit curriculum for kids 1st to 12th grade, age-appropriate kind of career exploration, improving the number of counselors and the support that they can give kids, going back to the adults and their influence. The number of students per counselor ratio, the average in the state of Michigan is 700 students per counselor. That's unacceptable to give them the individualized, customized attention that a student needs to talk about these multiple pathways. So it's those kinds of things that we really hope to inject into not just we'd like for you to do it, but really making it part of the school improvement plan, making it part of the Michigan Merit curriculum. And speaking of which, another one is showing the flexibility within the Michigan Merit curriculum.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Exactly what does that mean?
You know, there's so much flexibility built into that now. And what you'll hear is, oh, 18 of the 24 credits, you know, are mandated, and you have to have Algebra 2, and you have to have foreign language. And I think there's a lot of flexibility now. If a school will ask for a waiver, they can do a lot of different things with the kids who want to go into career and technical education. There's some work that we do want to do, like making computer programming a substitute, if you will, for some of the foreign language credits. So there's things like that that we're taking up with the legislature, but there's a lot of flexibility built into that now. And what we want to do is take it even a little bit further. And I'll give you a great example. When we toured the Upper Peninsula, the governor and I saw some great programs called geometry and carpentry. And what they have done is they've taken the geometry requirement in the Michigan Merit curriculum and combined it with a robust carpentry program, which there's a huge shortage of carpenters in the state of Michigan, and combine that for kids to be able to understand, have the hands-on application. And kids that would normally be in the classroom totally confused by what was being taught in the theory now are able to go out and see the practice, and vice versa. Kids that excel in the classroom will get the hands-on application. And both teachers, the construction teacher and the geometry teacher, are involved in this. And so it was just a great way to blend these two, the traditional math, I guess you will, that we see in the merit curriculum with the career and technical education piece, and see all the kids excel. That was just fantastic. And so we want to get that out to more districts and provide those resources to help those districts come up with those kinds of programs.
And when we say resources, will that mean money?
Oh, absolutely. It will mean money, but more importantly, I think it's the money to pay for experts that can go out and help bring, because this is not a normal conversation. I mean, one, it's a time issue for schools to be able to get, I'll go back to the example, the geometry teacher and the construction teacher, or it could be the algebra teacher and the advanced manufacturing teacher at the tech center, to bring them together, to get them to understand what we want to accomplish, and to literally build that module for the curriculum that works for both the Michigan Merit curriculum as well as the CTE program. It can be done, but a lot of schools need that help and support from a professional standpoint to make it happen.
Roger, knowing that you need the help of the legislature for some of these recommendations and steps, some of them can begin, what kind of timetable do you have in your mind? How long do you before we really start seeing these steps being implemented in Michigan schools?
I'd like to do it today. So I want to move very fast, because this is a very serious situation, and I feel like we're letting a generation of kids go with pathways that are not as spread out as they should be for them. And seeing my kids go through school, I want to make sure that they have a lot of different choices and options to go at their speed and go at their pace. So we're working with the legislature now. We've got meetings already. They're back in session, and we're going to jump on it. And I think we're going to be very successful. As I mentioned earlier, we have bipartisan support. I mean, closing the skilled trades gap, the professional trades gap, is important to all of us statewide, both parties. It's one of probably the most unifying issues we have right now in government, not just in the state of Michigan, but at the federal level as well. And the governor is a huge supporter of this. And to see the Department of Education, Superintendent Wiston and his team, really support and think creatively and innovatively like they have with these initiatives has just been fantastic. Because I know sometimes they get a bad rap throughout the state. And this is a case where I think Superintendent Wiston and his team are doing fantastic work, and very excited to be partnered with them on it.
Roger Curtis, the Michigan Department of Talent and Economic Development Director, who is shepherding the Michigan Career Pathways Alliance through the byways of Lansing and throughout Michigan schools. Thanks so much for being with us, Roger.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.